Blog Talk Radio.
And now, a moment from the Movie Geeks United Archive.
Ellen Burstyn, just a dynamite actress.
Oh,
I mean, we
yeah.
all know her from The Exorcist is probably her most infamous role.
I like that infamous. I like that. It's a good choice of words. Good.
Yeah, but do you think about how demanding that movie was and that role?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right.
Physically, emotionally, I mean, and she's the star of the film.
Mm-hmm.
She gives it a lot of resonance.
Mm-hmm. And the ones that you've chosen to work with, the best, Scorsese and Friedkin and Aronofsky and on and on and on, these seem to be very edgy filmmakers, and I'm wondering what qualities you respond to most from a director.
Well, I love creativity, period. And if a director is creative in any way, whether it's with the camera or the text or the whole overall conception, I get turned on by other people's creativity. So, like, mm-hmm. being around somebody like Marty or Darren Aronofsky, it's exciting, and it lights a fire under me or adds flame to my fire. So those are my favorite directors, the ones that are imaginative.
Welcome, and thank you for joining Movie Geeks United this evening. A very special show for you tonight. Director William Friedkin for the full hour. And since it is such a lengthy interview, we're going to delve right into the interview, and then we'll come back with a little roundtable discussion with my fellow Movie Geek co-hosts. But let's get right to it. William Friedkin exists in the pantheon of our most interesting and influential filmmakers. This Academy Award-winning director has made a number of films that can rightfully be heralded as true masterworks, The French Connection, The Exorcist, and To Live and Die in L.A. chief among them. But the totality of his work, from Sorcerer to Cruising to Rampage to Bug, complete the portrait of an artist who is unafraid to tackle challenging and oftentimes incendiary topics. With a claustrophobic and bruising style and an open-eyed approach to dramatizing the ambiguities and contradictions of the human psyche, these qualities certainly define his latest film, Killer Joe, which tells the story of a young man who hires a hitman to dispatch of his mother for the reward of her life insurance policy. This NC-17 film stars Matthew McConaughey, Emile Hirsch, and Gina Gershon, and opens in select theaters starting July 27th. Over the course of the 68-minute conversation, Mr. Friedkin and I discussed the qualities that generally characterize his work, how The Exorcist might be different if he were to make it today, the ongoing legal battles that plague his epic 1977 film Sorcerer, and his views on the current state of cinema.
So you guys are united, huh? United to do what? Take over the world? Or?
United to celebrate cinema. That's what we're all about.
Well, that's a very noble ideal, and I appreciate it.
Maybe.
Don't need bathing now, Jamie.
Well, that's part of what I want to talk to you about film as it is today, because when I think of you and your work and the work of so many other directors that I greatly admire, they seem to be to play a key role in the film culture of the time. We really seem to have a film culture then. Do you sense any of that remaining today?
Well, it's different. You know, the zeitgeist was different in the 70s. It was starting to change in the 60s when I started to make films. But by the 70s, it had definitely changed. And then it went through, a number of transformations to where it is today, which is largely a vehicle. I'm talking about cinema, is largely a vehicle for comic books and video games and old television shows and stuff. And even the European films, which so influenced my generation, are certainly, I don't see too many masterpieces coming out of Europe today either.
Mm.
So, but this happens. I mean, the culture was quite different and not all that bad when I started making films. And many of my colleagues and I, we couldn't wait for the next film by the French New Wave or the Italian neorealists or Kurosawa and some of the other Japanese directors. And now I find myself really not in sync with what is popular in this country.
I feel the same way, and I've spoken to many people about this, including years ago I had a conversation with Paul Schrader, and he was talking about how he believes that cinema going to the movies is going to be relegated to being a theme park experience.
But that's the new generation. I have to tell you, I honestly don't bemoan it. It just is the way it is, and I think the entire culture has gone that way, not just films. The kind of paintings that are appreciated today and this kind of music, popular music, there's been a vast deterioration to anyone that's ever experienced anything else. For example, you can't expect people to continue painting like Rembrandt or Vermeer, or, let's say, to turning out popular music like Cole Porter and the Gershwins.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a vast sea change for every generation in all the arts. And there is one now in cinema, without a doubt. Now, only time will tell whether this is just sour grapes or whether it in fact represents a deterioration of the culture.
Well, that's kind of what worries me, because I think of the films you did, pick a filmmaker from that period of time when you were coming up, Altman, Scorsese, just pick one. And a lot of their works were, even if they were subversive, they dealt with kind of social commentary. And I think that the movies of today might reflect an apathy that is troubling to me.
There is an apathy. You have to look at the late 60s and the Vietnam protests. And, I was in Chicago in 68, the convention, where Humphrey had been nominated to become to be the Democratic nominee. And the kids, mostly led by young people, were all in the park protesting the war. And for a few years before that. Now I think we're in wars every bit as stupid, if not more so, than Vietnam was. It's been a continuation of stupid wars that have ground up our young people, while these old dudes sit up there in Washington and eat $300 martini lunches and screw up the economy. But there's nobody in the streets, and the people that are in the streets seem to me to be more or less just hellraisers, not people with a legitimate sense of protest. So that's changed. Yes, there is an apathy. In the 60s, what was going on today, the attack on Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, all of that would be wildly protested. And now, I don't know, maybe it's the drug culture that kicked in, most of the people are apathetic. Where are you, by the way? What part of the country are you in?
I'm actually in Florida at the moment.
Okay, well, here in California, the legislature has so messed up the mm-hmm. state's economy that public education, as we know it now, is doomed. You know, there's no money in this state. And yet a lot of taxes were collected, but they went to graft, corruption, cronyism. They didn't go to the schools or to fix the roads or to make the state safer. I don't know where they went, where this money went. And there is a vast layer of corruption over most of the states and the country itself, and very few people speaking out against it. In fact, the journalists of this state and this country seem to be narcotized. And, you know, I don't know if cinema can do anything about that. I think it's just headed on a different path, which I find to be very sad, very sad. Look at the generation of young people that have been ruined by participating in these horrible wars that have gotten us nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the last war that meant anything was World War II. And, you know, it was a just and righteous war, and I think the outcome was good. After that, we've squandered the human and natural and financial resources of this country. But I don't see that in the movies anywhere. I see a celebration of all that.
Well, and of course there were troubled times in past decades, including the greatest decades for film, because the artists reflected and kind of commented on the times that we're living in. And I see the world of today, and I think, well, it's more important than ever for artists to feel that connection to the world and express it.
Yeah, but you don't see it in cinema.
No.
You know, you had a different kind of, to just stay with film, you had different kinds of filmmakers who were motivated largely by literature and their own life experiences. And today they're motivated by old television shows, video games, and comic books.
Right.
And I enjoyed comic books when I was a kid, but that wasn't the steady diet of movies that we had.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think about the artists, the great artists that inspired you, and it's something that always strikes me as curious about where people draw their inspirations. I mean, you were inspired by, you know, I'm sure, Wells, Hitchcock, the French New Wave, all of those giants. But was there a moment when you felt that you transcended those inspirations and found your own unique voice?
No. I mean, the thing that keeps me going, the reason I keep making films is because, one of the major reasons, because I know that the audience that I once had is not out there anymore. But what keeps me going is I haven't made a film anywhere near as good as Citizen Kane or, let's say, for example, Psycho or many others. And, you know, I still cling to the delusion that as long as I am able to keep at it, maybe one day, you know. But no, I mean, there are four people that really changed cinema. First was Griffith. Griffith set the whole style and tone for the kind of cinema that was then made in America and attempted throughout the world. And then that was basically in the silent era. The next person who changed cinema was Orson Welles with Citizen Kane. He synthesized everything that had gone before, and he pointed the way to where film could go. And then it was Jean-Luc Godard with Breathless, which is still echoing throughout the zeitgeist. More films, more television, as well as films, are made closer to Breathless than anything else. The jump cuts, the kind of loosey-goosey style, anything goes. It was kind of like modern art changed to painting. And then finally, I think the last real change was 1977, Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And the Star Wars reverberation continues today. You know, that's the most influential film, I would say, of my time. And that's where it is today. Possibly something will come along, who knows when, and change it again with the new media that's come on, you know.
Did you feel when Star Wars did come out in 77, I mean, you were coming off of The Exorcist and The French Connection, and you were tackling Sorcerer, I believe. Did you feel that sea change at that time? I mean, was it evident?
Soon after. You know, not immediately. It was a film that really captured the enthusiasm of people of all ages. And that it would have a wider impact, no, I didn't feel that. But soon after, you could see that was the direction that all the major studios wanted to head in, and that's where they are now. They're just still doing Star Wars, only with better technology.
I wanted to ask you a question about, and I guess it relates to cinema today, about the type of material that you are attracted to. Do you find it more difficult to find something that really turns you on enough to invest your time and talent in?
Jamie, you know, I think I've only made 15 or 16 films in, I don't know, at least 45 years of doing it. And it's not for lack of trying. There are very few things that really interest me. You know, I've directed a lot of operas over the last 14 years now. I've directed about 14 operas and all over the world. And that's a fascinating new challenge for me. But, no, I don't see a lot of things, nor do I get a lot of ideas that I think I could get financed. You know, it's not simply what a filmmaker would like to do. It's who's going to finance it. It was put best by a dear old friend of mine who's now passed away, Sammy Kahn, the lyricist. Have you ever heard of him?
Yes, sir.
You know, Sammy Kahn was one of the great lyricists. He wrote Come Fly With Me. He wrote, 50 or more hits, many of them for Frank Sinatra. And he was often asked, what comes first, the music or the lyrics? And his answer was always the phone call. And that's really where it's at, you know. The phone call standing in for the financier, some guy who wanted a song written. That's how it used to work. A publishing company or a particular artist would want a love song or an up-tempo song or whatever, and Sammy and his writing partners would come up with the song.
Mm.
And they became classics. They became standards. Today, you know, that phone call doesn't come around too often. There are only a handful of people, I think, and I can't even name them, who could make exactly what they want to make. I mean, you take even the great American filmmakers of today. They have to make films whose primary aim is to make money. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, film is a commercial medium. Popular Hollywood film. It's a commercial medium. No one ever called it show art, you know? It's show business. And so even the great filmmakers who are around have got to try and do something that a lot of people want to see, or they're not going to be able to make films. And frankly, there's not a lot of things that I think would work that interest me. for today's audience.
But even so, I mean, it's obvious that in Tracy Letts, in his work, you've found someone simpatico with you. What is it about his particular voice that you identify with so much?
Well, he and I guess, share the same worldview, you know? We are fascinated by these characters who live sort of desperate lives with their backs against the wall. They contain equal parts of good and evil. They embody equal parts of good and evil. There are no heroes. You know, I could cite many more examples of how we see the world, not with rose-colored glasses. Mm-hmm. He also happens to be, you know, a really first-rate dramatist. Not just my opinion. You know, he's won the Pulitzer Prize and for drama and the Tony Award. He has a terrific, unique, contemporary voice. He was out here in Hollywood for, I think, 6 years or so. I didn't know him then, but he couldn't get a job. He couldn't get a script assignment, and he tried to be an actor. He's now a very successful actor. You know, he's going to star in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf on Broadway this fall. And he was out here for 6-7 years trying to work as an actor, a writer. He couldn't even get a meeting. He couldn't get on the Love Boat. And so he went back to Chicago, which has become the most important theatrical city in America in terms of originating the new drama. And he's flourished there. And I haven't, well, I directed one of his plays, too, here in Orange County at the South Coast Rep. I directed his play, The Man from Nebraska. So I've done three of his pieces, two on film. And he hasn't done that many more. I don't know how many. I think he's only written 5 or 6 plays. But I've liked the other two as well. But it's not like I'm just looking to do to adapt plays by Tracy Letts. But I think he's a great writer today. He's as good as there is in this country.
My payment is $25,000 in cash in advance. No exceptions.
25?
Yes, sir.
I thought you said 20.
I was told 20.
25. Is that a problem?
We don't have a problem with 25. That's not our problem.
Then what is your problem?
We have a problem with the advance.
No exceptions.
Sir, let me explain. One of the reasons we're interested in having this done is my mother holds a very large insurance policy.
They usually do.
Now, we thought if we could guarantee payment after the policy had been covered...
But this really isn't open for discussion. Conversation is finished.
This is
what you think this was, huh? Let's make a deal? This is serious business you're fucking with here, boy.
I'm aware of that.
No, I don't think you are. I don't take you seriously.
This is gonna get done one way or another.
Our conversation is finished. I never met you. You never met me.
Well, when I think about your work, and Killer Joe definitely is included in this, I think of characteristics like they're surprising, they're a little bit dangerous, and there's a streak of ambiguity that runs across many of the themes and characters. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. Well, life is ambiguous, Jamie. You know, we don't know the ending. We certainly don't know the beginning. There are just great mysteries surrounding us. And one of the things that interested me the most around the time I made The Exorcist was the mystery of faith. You know, what it is and why and how deep are people's beliefs. And that still fascinates me.
Mm-hmm.
There are other mysteries. Of course, everything around us is a mystery. We have nothing to say about when or to whom or how we're born. Nothing to say about how we're going to leave this veil. But also love is a mystery. You know, why two people can meet and fall in love, and somebody else can meet the same people and not even notice them.
Mm-hmm.
Birth is a mystery. There are all these great mysteries. Nothing seems to be resolved. And so why should drama wrap everything up in a neat package when, you know, it's not a neat package? What fascinates me enormously, even as I get older, since and even before The Exorcist, was here was this man, this young Jewish man in his early 30s, walking around the diaspora, a very small part of the world in the Middle East, and he would preach in the street and on hillsides and in synagogues and to very small venues, and he died, I guess, at the age of 32 or 33 after having preached only 3 years that we're aware of. And he walked around in a robe and sandals, mostly in the desert, and begged his food. If anyone had told you then that, you know, that trillions of people would believe in this man as a deity, that they would have said you were crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And trillions of people have this belief. That's what interests me the most. Not only the story of Jesus, but Buddha and Muhammad, you know, and Moses. This mystery of faith. And then the opposite of that, Adolf Hitler, you know, really a homeless tramp who was unemployed, begging for money in the streets of Vienna. And it was a guy you wouldn't look at twice. And then an entire race of the most intelligent people on earth followed this imbecile into hell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are the great mysteries that I still think about and read about and talk about.
Well, that ambiguity that you talk about, I love that in film as well. And not only for the reasons that you've just articulated, but, you know, the past couple of years we've been studying on the show the films of Kubrick, and we've brought on about 60 of his collaborators. And the one thread that keeps coming up is the ambiguity of his work. And I find that what that does is you can watch a Kubrick movie at the age of 20. It can mean one thing, and then it kind of redefines itself when you watch
right.
it years later, because you are different. You're bringing something different to it.
You're absolutely right. You know, I continue to watch Paths of Glory in 2001, Dr. Strangelove, and The Killing.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the four Kubrick films that have resonated the most with me. But I thought his work was a revelation when we saw it. I think the first thing I saw was The Killing. And it's one of the great, you know, genre films. It's a B picture, but it transcends that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's hard to believe, but 2001 was heavily criticized, if not ridiculed in its day by the critics. But it influenced a whole generation of young people. I didn't list that as one of the films that changed cinema, but, you know, in many ways it did, but things didn't go that way. Things
mm-hmm.
didn't go toward the mysteries of life or the ambiguity. They went the opposite way.
Yeah.
But 2001 is the most ambiguous of all films. And the films that resonate with me are films like that, where at the end of the film, it's left with you. It's left with the audience to make of it what you will. In many ways, The Exorcist was that, too. I'm not talking about the quality of The Exorcist versus 2001, but I found that what people brought to that film, to The Exorcist, is what they took away from it. If you believe that the world was a dark and evil place, you know, where little children were mysteriously destroyed from within, that's what you took away from The Exorcist. If, on the other hand, you thought that there was a force for good, constantly at war with the darker forces within us, and that sometimes they would triumph, not always, but sometimes, that's what you took away from the film. The same mm-hmm. with 2001. You know, what is that slab? You know, to many people, the obelisk has no meaning, or it's just confusing. To me, it's the most profound statement of the mystery of faith I've ever seen in a film.
Yeah.
And the mystery of a kind of a divine presence in our lives that we are not meant to understand. It's the most seriously agnostic film I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Agnosticism being, you know, a belief that the power of God and the soul are unknowable. Not that they don't exist, but that they are unknowable. And I think that's, to me, is the ultimate message of 2001.
I think so too, and I see it in The Exorcist as well. I mean, you always talk about The Exorcist as an exploration of the mystery of faith, as you just have. But I'm wondering, as you've lived your life since The Exorcist, and your faith and understanding of things has evolved, do you think if you were to make The Exorcist today that you would have made it in any way different?
You couldn't make The Exorcist today the way I made it. It would have to be ludicrous, the way all of these Exorcist sequels and ripoffs have been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd have to escalate all the special effects. It would all have to be so wildly supernatural and without any kind of realistic base to even get considered today.
Mm-hmm.
No, you couldn't. Even though the film, as you probably know, remains enormously popular and is continuing to be seen by, you know, vast hordes of people all over the world. One of the reasons for that is we've with Warner Brothers, we've kept it alive. You know, we've made versions of the film that look like the film was made yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing dated about it. But the idea of the story itself, the way Blatty wrote it, and the way I interpreted it, no, you couldn't do that today. It would have to be, you know, complete bullshit,
mm-hmm.
which is what these films are. They are not made by people who are exploring the idea of a faith-based society. They're just made to rip people off and sell tickets. You couldn't make it today, no.
I don't think you could either. But what interests me is a director such as yourself, your relationship with your previous work. Because I suppose one way to look at it would be, you look at The Exorcist and you think that's where I was at that point of my life. That's like a marker of who I was then. Do you still feel that you completely relate to the William Friedkin that made The Exorcist at that time? Are you still in that same place?
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, that's an omega point, a story like The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it isn't something that once you reach that point, you then back away or transcend it. No, my interests remain the same. I believe, because I know so much about the actual case on which this film is based, I know that something happened in that case that was either, how can I put this? It was either mass hallucination or something transcendent that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
There were, in the 20th century, there were only three cases known that the Catholic Church had authenticated as demonic possession in this country. Now, today around the world, you have guys who claim to be exorcists or priests or whatever, and many of them do two or three exorcisms before breakfast, you know? And there's a guy in the Vatican who is the Vatican's official exorcist. His name is Father Gabriel Amorth, A-M-O-R-T-H. And he claims to have done thousands of exorcisms. And to me, he just gives exorcism a bad name. I think there were very few. I think in our time, I think to a great extent, obviously I wasn't around during the 1949 case, but possibly there are other solutions to the affliction of that young man then, who was 14 years old. He's still alive today with no memory of what happened to him. And, you know, the church through the Jesuit diocese in the Washington area still keeps an eye on him because he lives back in that area. And clearly, from my reading of the files of the case, which were given to me by Father Henley, who was the president of Georgetown, Father Robert Henley, one day he sat me down and let me read the files, which included the diaries of the doctors and the nurses as well as the priests who were involved in that case. And it was clear to me that something transcendent had occurred. And I don't know whether you ever saw the Washington Post front page article about that case in 1949. Have you ever seen that?
I haven't, no.
You can Google it. It's out there. It's written by a reporter who was on the Washington Post called Bill Brinkley. It's a front page article that runs for over two full pages. And it describes this incident in 1949 in the Silver Spring, Maryland area, which Brinkley refers to as a case of demonic possession that was in fact cured by this lengthy exorcism as performed by the church. And it's very rare to see something like that given credibility on the front page of a major American newspaper. You know, that wasn't the Inquirer. Bill Brinkley later went on and became a very successful novelist. He wrote a comic novel called Don't Go Near the Water, which became a film. But all laid out in this newspaper on the front page, the upper left-hand column is where it starts with a big headline, is a description of that case.
Wow.
And that and the diaries and other things that I've been privy to have have deepened my faith. But I don't have any ultimate conclusions because I'm not Catholic. I believe that the organized religion is basically pretty far from the teachings of Jesus. You know, I mentioned a guy who walked around in a robe and sandals, and now you see, you know, the fathers of the church wearing costumes and, you know, gold-plated silver, you know, they eat off fine china, and they drink great wine, and they own banks, and they own real estate, and it looks like a lot of dress-up, you know, and it's just not what I perceive as the teachings of Jesus. But, you know, God moves in mysterious ways, as they say.
Dr. Klein.
Yes, I'm Dr. Klein. This is Dr. Taylor.
Sharon, things have gotten worse since I phoned you. I think you better come upstairs.
Is she having spasms again?
Yeah, but they've gotten violent.
Did you give her the medication I gave you?
Yes.
What was that? Where is he? Well, that was Ritalin.
Chris, doctors.
Mother,
Dr.
please! Mother, please!
Dr. Taylor.
Oh, please!
What is it? What's happening?
Stop! It's burning! It's burning!
There's something, Doctor. Please help her!
Please!
I have to ask you about this particular film, because when I announced to our many of our listeners that we were going to welcome you on the show, the overwhelming majority of them wanted to know about Sorcerer. And I understand this is your most requested film.
It's a very strange thing that's happened to Sorcerer. As a matter of fact, I think the first point in the legal case that I brought against Paramount and Universal, the first response is today, and I'll know either today or tomorrow how this will be continued. But for many years, both Paramount and Universal allowed the film to be shown. It's still available on a very bad and an old VHS, which I didn't make. It's the only one of my films that went to DVD or Blu-ray that I had nothing to do with. They just sort of snuck it under the radar. But for many years, both studios that had financed it had made it available to film societies and universities and all over the world. As recently as last year, the American Cinematheque had a retrospective of my films, and, you know, it was a huge success here. And they ran Sorcerer. Paramount made a new print of Sorcerer last year. And then all of a sudden, these requests were denied by both studios. And they both claimed that they didn't know who owned the picture. Mm. They had no record of whether Paramount owned any rights or Universal. And none of these film societies could... or schools could get it anymore. By the way, this has happened to a number of other films, such as Blade Runner and White Dawn that Phil Kaufman had made, many others. And it appears, I mean, they wrote to us saying, we don't know who owns the film. We don't anymore. We can't say who does. Now, I understand that the film was put into a joint corporation that Paramount and Universal had formed a number of years ago, well, you know, over 30 years ago. They formed a company called CIC, Cinema International Corporation, that was set up for the purpose of jointly distributing Paramount and Universal's properties overseas. They were not licensed to do business in the United States, CIC, only, you know, Europe, Latin America, and elsewhere. And that company has long since folded. And so there's that development, and there's the fact that the studios want to erase all memory of 35-millimeter film. They mm-hmm. want to convert to the new media as quickly as possible. That is, DVD, Blu-ray, or whatever is going to very soon follow it. And Eastman Kodak no longer makes 35-millimeter stock. So within 2 years, nothing will be shot on 35, and, you know, you'll only be able to see it in revival houses, and the prints will all be very bad because there's nobody around who cares about, you know, film preservation, really. And so I sued Paramount and Universal to determine the ownership of the rights. And their response is due today. We've asked them to produce every imaginable document pertaining to Sorcerer. And my personal belief is that they don't have them. Mm. That what they've done is what the studios have always done, is destroy their legacy. They don't really want you or people to see an old movie. They want you to see a new movie. They've stopped being cooperative with film societies, with rare exception. I mean, Warner Brothers will still make all of their stuff available to you know, legitimate film societies and universities. But Paramount and Universal have started a process to eliminate all of that. And Sorcerer fell between the cracks there. So I'm trying to determine ownership. And, you know, it may well be that I own the film, in which case I will make it available to anybody, you know, any legitimate organization that wants to run it. It's a very unique and original suit. But they are claiming they don't know who owns the rights. Now, there's a bunch of young lawyers at all the studios now who really have no memory of the studio's past. And what they largely do is after a certain time period, they destroy all the files. So they may not know who owns it. But they did as of last year, when they had this enormously successful run of it at the Cinematheque. And I was there. I did a Q&A, and they had lines around the block to see it. There's a group here called Cine Family, a group of, you know, film lovers like yourself and others. They requested it, and that's how this came up. The studio sent them emails saying, we have no idea who owns this, and we don't. And that's what provoked my legal action against both studios. And all we're asking for, we're not asking for money from these studios, we're just asking for, you know, the right to keep the film in circulation to those who want to see it.
Well, yeah, you're trying to save your film. And I would imagine that the ultimate goal would be, would it be a Blu-ray release so everyone can have access to it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I said in my lawsuit, I've said, this is not about money. If I receive any money as a result of obtaining the rights to Sorcerer, I will donate it to film restoration and preservation.
Mm-hmm.
Every dime.
Mm.
So I just want the film seen.
Suspense. Adventure. Mystery. Danger. Courage. Sorcerer. Roy Scheider in a new film by William Friedkin. Sorcerer. Rated PG. Starts Friday at a theater near you.
Sorcerer was an incredibly ambitious film for you. And it's grown in stature as the years have gone by. But when it was first released and it didn't really perform as well as I'm sure you had hoped, how did you take to that? How did that affect you?
Jamie, let me try and explain this to you. When you say didn't perform as well as I hoped, I thought that I made the film as well as I could.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Scheider, who was the lead, and even the other cast, with the exception of a young Moroccan actor named Amadou, who was my first choice, none of them were my first choices. The script was written for Steve McQueen, and Steve McQueen loved it and wanted to do it, but he had just married Ally McGraw, and they were very close, and he wanted me to write a role in for Ally McGraw. And he had told me that it was the best script that he had read. And could I write a part in there for Ally? And I said, gee, Steve, you just told me it's the best script you ever read. There really is no major role for a woman. I'd have to change the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, all right, all right. He said, are you going to shoot it in this country? And I said, no, I found some fantastic locations where I want to shoot it. Very primitive and rugged locations. He said, well, you could find that here in the United States. He said, because I can't, you know, I don't want to be away from Ally. I said, well, I'm not going to shoot it in the United States, except for one sequence. And then he said, well, okay, make her the associate producer or something. And I was really arrogant at that time, possibly only a little bit less so now. But I said, no, I don't believe in that credit, associate producer.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't believe in it, and I'm not going to do it. And I was an idiot. I didn't realize then what I've come to realize, that a close shot of Steve McQueen, you know, is worth the most beautiful landscape you can photograph. And if the same situation occurred today, I would do whatever I had to do to get McQueen into that film, because if I had McQueen, then Marcello Mastroianni would have signed on to one of the other parts, and Lino Ventura, who was a great French star, one of the best film actors ever. And they would not take second or third billing to Roy Scheider. Now, I think Roy was great in the film. I really do. But Roy was not a movie star, and I think the film needed that. On the other hand, I'm happy with the film, Jamie. I love the film. Despite the fact that it was a financial failure and that the critics mostly, you know, dumped all over it, the film works for me. Now, I don't compare this in any way to, let's say, the work of some of the great artists in the past who got no recognition. But you take Vincent van Gogh, who had made well over 3,000 works of art in 10 years and never sold one.
Mm-hmm.
He never sold a painting, but he continued to paint. And now you can't buy a Van Gogh, you know, for less than $10 or $20 million. And Van Gogh never made any money on his films, but he continued to paint. I have not ever thought about simply making films to make money. Now, I realize you're better off if your films do make money, in that they hopefully appeal to a wide audience and they bring back the investment to the bankers. But I'm not a banker, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've really been blessed by the fact that I was able to make films. I never went to college. I never went to film school. I've never really had a lesson in film. And I've made about 15 or 16 films. Some of them I like, some of them I don't. Some of them I think work, and when I say work, I mean for me. I can't put myself into the mind's eye of other people, Jamie.
Well, there are
people I know who love and revere Sorcerer, and I'm very grateful for that. But if I hated it, it would mean nothing to me.
Well, I didn't mean to be at all dismissive when what I said it
oh,
didn't
you weren't.
Perform.
No, it's a legitimate question when I tried to answer it as honestly as I can.
No, I understand, but it actually mirrors what we discussed with 2001. I mean, as the years went on, people recognized I misunderstood that movie, and they looked back at it and they thought, "Well, this is a masterwork." And I feel that the same thing has happened to Sorcerer.
Well, 2001 is a masterpiece. People just didn't recognize it at the
exactly.
time.
Exactly.
As they didn't recognize Vermeer's View of Delft. You know, are you familiar with Vermeer and the View of Delft?
I'm sorry to say I'm not. No, sir.
Well, Johannes Vermeer is perhaps one of the greatest artists who ever lived. He lived in the 17th century in a little town called Delft in the Netherlands. As far as we know, he never left Delft. We don't know anything. There's no pictures of Vermeer, no portraits that we know of. There are only 35 surviving canvases by Vermeer, no sketches. We don't know if he ever studied or with whom. It took 2.5 centuries for Vermeer's work to be discovered, and I first saw these paintings, 21 of them, were gathered together at the National Gallery here for the first time in Washington. And I saw them, and it was a life-changing experience. Now, Vermeer died broke in his lifetime at the age of about 43. And he died broke and crazed. He had a wife and 13 children.
Mm.
And there was a custom in this little town of Delft that when someone died, when any citizen of Delft died, the city fathers would come around and they'd collect his clothing and donate it to the poor. Vermeer's clothes were so ragged and in ruins that they simply burned them. And his wife had to give many of these paintings away to the baker and the grocer and others to pay their debts a year and a half after he died. Today, of the 35 known Vermeers, the view of Delft, which is to me the greatest piece of landscape painting I've ever seen, it's a cityscape. Today, well, in 1995, when it was brought over to the United States for the first and only time to the National Gallery, it was insured for $100 million.
Wow, wow.
Now, go figure. Vermeer, as far as we know, seldom, he died because he couldn't sell any of his work. So I mention this to you not to put myself anywhere near the genius or the talent of some of the great artists who've ever lived, but simply to say that the value of a work is very often not apparent in its own time. And so, look, it's consolation enough to me to know that Van Gogh's entire output and Vermeer's small output were not recognized then but are now. Now, I don't know what will happen to the films I've made, you know, after I'm gone. I have no idea. They could be forgotten, like the work of a lot of filmmakers whose work I admired. It's hard to see anywhere a Richard Brooks film anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very hard to see an Elia Kazan film. Very difficult to see a film by Carl Theodore Dreyer or even Antonioni. You know, things move very quickly and they move on to the next case. And that's what happens if you are fortunate enough to be able to create something on this earth to ever have it be recognized in its time.
Right. One collaboration that fascinates me, and a film that fascinates me, it's really stayed with me, is Rampage. And your collaboration with Morricone on that film. What can you tell me about that?
Well, you know, I think Morricone and Bernard Herrmann were the two greatest composers of film music for me. And I just called him out of the blue after I'd filmed Rampage, and I sent him a work print copy, and he called me back. He spoke very little English, but he had an agent who spoke good English, and I went with him, and I met with him, and I really wanted a kind of a driving score from Morricone that would drive the film more, like the score he did for a film called Investigation of a Citizen Without Investigation of a Citizen Under Suspicion, something like that. It was a great movie. And I wanted a score like that. And he didn't see the film that way. He saw the film as a tragedy. And a tragedy not only involving the victims of this guy, who was known as the vampire killer in Northern California. He saw it as a tragedy of human nature. And I kept pushing Morricone to write some more driving rhythms, but he couldn't. He wrote one of his most moving and deep scores. And we weren't completely in agreement about it, but God knows it was a thrill to be working with him. And every time I heard, you know, something that he had written, I have to be honest and tell you, I didn't think it worked. And I kept asking for a more energetic, it was called Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion, a police chief who was murdering women in order to be able to investigate and solve their murders. It's a great film by a director called Elio Petri. But I worked with Morricone at his apartment in Rome, and at the time he was concentrating on writing classical music, you know, for concerts, and doing fewer scores. But I must say, it's a time in my life that I have great memories of having worked with him on that.
And the other collaboration, and it concerns your new movie. You're working with one of the great cinematographers, in Caleb Deschanel. And I'm curious about not only your collaboration with him, but your relationship with your DP on your films in general.
They all differ. You know, I mean, basically, The French Connection was Owen Roisman's first film. He had done another film, I think that he shot in Puerto Rico or something, but I don't even know if it was ever released. But I met him before I did The French Connection, and he was like 31 years old and had really not done anything, but he did this one feature. I don't remember the title of it, but he had done a lot of commercials in New York. I didn't want to see any of his commercials. I met him up at the equipment rental house in New York, where we all used to rent cameras and stuff. And I liked him, and I told him my ideas for the film, and he said, great, I love that. And so I took him without ever really knowing his work. And then I did The Exorcist with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's several other cinematographers that I had a good relationship with, like John Alonzo, who I'd worked with in documentary, and then later Robbie Mueller. Caleb, the first film we did together was The Hunted a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew him socially, and he had great misgivings about working with me because I had had a lot of problems over the years with cinematographers. A great many disagreements. And I was known to have cut a number of them loose. And so Caleb was concerned about that. But I think, you know, his curiosity about working with me led him to do The Hunted. And then when it came to this, to Killer Joe, I said, look, you're not going to want to do this because I'm going to do this for very little money. I'm going to make this is a very low-budget film. And he said, you know, I haven't shot that way in almost 50 years. And he said, maybe 30 years, but he said, I'd like to give it a shot. And so he went out and we got this Arriflex Alexa digital camera, which is, I think it's the first time it was used on a feature, or one of the first times. I think the results are quite beautiful. The 35mm prints are the best I've ever seen. And we're very close personal friends, Caleb and I now, and his family and mine. And he's just a wonderful human being.
Mm.
The spirit that he brings to all of his work, you know, comes from him and who he is. And he's a really wonderful, decent guy, one of the most straightforward people I've met, you know, out here in California in the industry. He threw himself, we never made more than one or two takes in Killer Joe.
Do you find that the digital format, does it allow you a greater versatility at all?
To some extent, yes. I'll tell you where it really shines is in post-production. The prints that you're able to make from it, the latitude that you have to achieve greater contrast, deeper, richer blacks, more vivid colors if you want them, or desaturated colors, whatever you choose, the latitude you have is far, far greater than we ever had with 35 millimeter, because 35 millimeter was subject to the vicissitudes of the printing process.
Mm-hmm.
By that I mean, you know, the developers are, the printing process always had serious flaws. The printers that are located in the valley, the water in the valley or anywhere else, the water that goes into the developer is changing constantly. You know, the little amoeba that are in the water are constantly changing, and the electricity that goes to the printer is constantly fluctuating. Now, sometimes to a greater or lesser degree, but we could never produce perfect prints. There would always be one reel that would come off bluish, another greenish. From shot to shot, you would get inconsistency because of the process, the changing nature of the water and the electricity. But none of that exists now with digital color timing. I mean, it took me, I think The Exorcist, for example, I think we threw away 20 reels for every reel that I approved because it was a highly imperfect process. You had far more latitude developing a still photograph than a whole reel or 12 reels or more of a film. And all that's gone now with digital. The results you get are similar to what you get when you're looking through the viewfinder of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing it a pure image in focus. And so, yes, I think you have more latitude, but especially in post-production. The process is still very new, but I'm very pleased with it. You know, 35 millimeter is now in the position of the 33 and a third LP.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's gone. Look, when they started recording music, you had all this needle scratch. You know, all this you had, like, some of the great voices that they recorded, like Enrico Caruso, but the voice was always preceded and often drowned out by needle scratch. You know, and if you could hear Caruso without any of the technical imperfections, why wouldn't you want to do that? You know, why would you still want to hear an original recording of Caruso covered with surface noise? And that's how I feel about the digital print versus the 35 millimeter. I think the digital is an evolution.
Well, there is digital, and there's a increasing reliance on 3D. I mean, someone even like Scorsese says that he wants to shoot 3D from now on.
I detest 3D, and I see no reason for it. To me, film and painting, any of the visual arts, is the illusion of depth in a two-dimensional image. I mean, I don't need 3D to look at a Rembrandt or a Da Vinci or a Michelangelo painting or a Vermeer or anybody else. I don't need 3D to look at a Picasso or a Braque Cubist painting.
Mm-hmm.
The illusion of depth is there, and that's part of the art of the visual arts. So I actually detest 3D.
Mm.
And it frankly hurts my eyes. And I think, you know, maybe someday someone will come along and be able to tell a useful story with it, but I haven't seen it yet. It's just a gimmick to me. I like IMAX because of the clarity of the image, but not 3D. What drew me to become a filmmaker was not anything to do with the technical abilities of the equipment.
Yeah.
What drew me was my interest in story and character. You know, that's what did and still does draw me. And the ability of film to produce emotions in people. whether it be to make them laugh or cry or be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I go to film for an emotional response. And there, you know, there are a lot of different kinds of film from which I've received that. A film like Alien scared the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And Psycho, you know, and a number of other films. And then a simple film like Love Story. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Yes.
No, I'm sorry, not Love Story. I a Man and a Woman was the love story I've ever seen. I think it was made for $100,000 or less with two people and a beautiful score. And I found it very moving. And it was made for no money, and there was no technical expertise all over it. Just a lovely, simple love story called A Man and a Woman. And there are many films that have produced this emotional response in me, and that's all I look for in a film. True with any work of art, a piece of music or a painting or a play. Look, you've got to be virtually a Nazi or an ex-Nazi not to cry during Death of a Salesman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that will always produce an emotional response in people.
I agree with you. I mean, it all comes down to, no matter what the technology is, it always comes down to the most ancient of arts, and that's storytelling.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Death of a Salesman was written, I guess, in the late 40s, 1940s. I haven't seen anything that has moved me more. And there was, when they made the film of it, there was no 3D in the film, no 48 frames per second,
mm-hmm.
no technical innovation whatsoever. Just well-drawn characters in a story that so many people could identify with, and I believe still can and do.
Yeah.
And that's what I want out of cinema, and which I get very little of. I'm not interested in the latest technical innovation. I admire them tremendously, but I won't see a 3D film just because it's in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Many others will, and it's just not for me.
Let me tell you that, I mean, you've given me so much time today. I just want to leave you with this and tell you that you've made such a mark on my life, and your films mean a great deal to me. So this has been a great pleasure to speak with you.
Well, your questions are great, Jamie, and I enjoyed doing it very much. And, you know, stay in touch.
Okay, that is director William Friedkin. A nice long conversation. He's such a great conversationalist. His new movie, Killer Joe, opens in select theaters on July 27th. You can find out more about the film at killerjoethemovie.com. And now I'm going to bring on Jerry and Dean. You guys have been sitting on the phone patiently.
Yeah, no, that was brilliant. That was probably one of the finest interviews you've ever conducted.
Yeah, it was great.
I mean, it was fantastic.
Him. Yeah, he was wonderful. I expected only to have something like 20 minutes with him. I thought, well, maybe this is a typical kind of interview, like a junket type interview, and then they said, well, you'll have at least an hour with him.
No, it was wonderful. It's what he said, and you know, at first you could say he's like, you know, bitter, but not at all. I mean, it's just a man who really just wants to tell stories. He's not really, he doesn't really care about the bells and whistles whatsoever.
Well, and he's, I mean, when you think of filmmakers that came up when he did,
mm-hmm.
you know, the greats that made those indelible films alongside of his in the 70s. You can easily kind of categorize those voices. You kind of know who Coppola is, or know who Scorsese is, and Altman. It's a little harder to peg Friedkin, and I think it's, I mean, first of all, he's made very few movies comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, several classics among them. But I think he really always pushed the boundaries. And sometimes that clicked, that worked absolutely,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes it didn't quite click. But he was always brave in his choices and his approach to his work.
Right.
And I think that defines his voice. There's kind of a fearlessness and a provocateur to Friedkin.
Well, he always seems to focus in on characters who are kind of fighting their own private war. I mean, usually these wars that they're fighting are extremely private. I mean, just in terms of just The Exorcist, for example, the war that's just being fought in this house. You know, it's a basic war between good and evil, kind of. You look at French Connection and Popeye Doyle, you know, kind of fighting his own war, which is, you know, I was thinking about French Connection today. You know, that's a very interesting movie for a statement on the drug war, because the movie sort of just has Popeye Doyle just disappearing off into the distance as if, you know, he can have absolutely no effect on the tidal wave of drugs entering into the country. And then, you know, Sorcerer, all those guys are fighting their own private wars to the point where they've subsumed their own personalities. And
right.
Then you go to, you know,
Bug.
To live and die in L.A., you
well,
know.
Bug, as recent as Bug, you get that.
Yeah, too. Yeah, exactly. And I love his sense of, again, his sense of ambiguity. You know, I love that part of the interview where he was talking about, you know, life being ambiguous itself.
Right.
Certainly his movies show that.
Well, and you know, you mentioned French Connection. That's a very abrasive Popeye Doyle. I mean, that's a very abrasive lead character in that film.
Mm-hmm.
A brute, you know, probably a racist. But he's the, you know, quote unquote hero of the story,
right?
And it would be a cut and dry kind of hero, good guy in any other kind of film. But Friedkin shows him warts and all. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's a very abrasive kind of portrayal.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't shy away from having those kind of characters. You know,
and that was indicative of the best movies of the 70s. That's
sure.
Not in any way indicative of the movies of today, but I still see him with something like Killer Joe or Bug or any of his later efforts like that. I still see him playing in that sandbox
mm-hmm.
When other filmmakers really don't. I mean, we've talked about how those legendary filmmakers of that period, how whether it's age or whether it's the changing state of movies, how they've somehow softened. I mean, I don't know, as much as I adore Scorsese, and I do, I don't know if he can get back to the kind of itchy, paranoia state of Taxi Driver.
I don't see how it's possible. I mean, I just don't.
Well, the only way that it's possible is doing what Friedkin is doing, and actually,
yeah.
You know, of course, I haven't seen Killer Joe yet, but returning back to a time where money, you know, going back to lower budgets, I think is the way, you know, for anybody to kind of revisit that period, you know, try and match what the budget would have been like back then, and try and don't cover up everything with money.
Right.
Or the look or the feel of money, you know. It's the only way to kind of return to a sort of grittiness, you know.
But I do see that Friedkin still has that, and De Palma still has that.
Both of them have that, I mean, in spades. I mean, my God, I mean, both of them have so much that I don't think either one, I mean, from both interviews, I don't think either one of them's happy. I mean, in that way, it feels like they've done what they've set out to do. They still feel like there's a lot of unfinished business.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great, and that's a good thing, and that's a very good thing to have. If you feel like you haven't really done your job yet, that's very important.
Yeah.
Well, there's this point, too. I mean, we talk about Friedkin the provocateur, and Killer Joe is NC-17. And that rating is upheld, and the company has taken the stance of embracing that rating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think I read sentiments of Friedkin on the NC-17 rating, saying that it's a fair rating. They didn't want to soften it at all.
Right.
But he thinks that the rating system is kind of whack in general, I'm sure. But
who doesn't?
do you think it... If more filmmakers kind of embrace this rating, it can legitimize it, or do you think it'll always hold the stigma of pornography?
Oh, I think you know, enough good filmmakers make good enough movies that are if they make movies that are, you know, transcend the rating and are actually just great movies. The more great movies with that rating, the more the rating gets legitimized. I think that's just the bottom line.
If the rating is the thing that the movie's most famous for, then no.
Yeah.
That's also, God, how do we say it? In the age that we live in, I really can't see how an NC-17 rating, what is so shocking in that movie that I can't go online and find. As sad as that is to say, nine times out of ten, it's true. It's really funny. The other day I saw what we would call a red band trailer in the theater. We can't show an explicit trailer in the theater. We have to go online to see it. I don't understand that exactly. I don't understand the logic.
Well, and when I say pornography, I don't mean that the movie's in any way pornographic.
I know what you mean.
Let me explain to listeners. What I'm saying is that the viewpoint a lot of people have of NC-17 is some kind of X-rated material,
right,
and they equate
right.
that with pornography.
That's true.
Yeah. But he spends a lot of time now directing operas, and his film output is getting less and less frequent.
Right.
But with Tracy Letts, the screenwriter of Bug and Killer Joe, I mean, as we discussed in the interview, he's really found a kinship with
right.
his voice. And something like Bug, and I see it with De Palma, too, being a political filmmaker. I mean, definitely Bug has political overtones.
Right.
Yes.
Subversive. Yeah. And he's somebody that's still very, very much in tune with film's capacity to express that,
mm-hmm.
express something about the world we're living in, as we discussed earlier on in the interview. Very few filmmakers do that anymore. They kind of want you to – they only try to sell you an escape from the world you're living mm-hmm. in. You know, not an understanding of it.
That's true. That's very true.
A couple other movies I actually do like of his. Blue Chips, I actually like. Nick mm-hmm. Nolte as the basketball coach in Broiled and kind of Scandal.
I've never seen that.
That's an intense Nick Nolte performance. It really is. And he's great with actors. I mean, he's directed, I think, five or six actors to Academy Award nominations and a win for Gene Hackman for French Connection. So he pulls the very best out of actors.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that Sorcerer, because honestly, I remember seeing a bit of it when I was very young, but I haven't seen any of it in years and years, and I'm hoping that that does get the release that
I have
serves.
That bad VHS copy. I think he's talking.
Oh, you do?
I do too. I definitely have that one.
And I'm happy to have it. I'm glad to have anything like that.
Yeah.
I'm glad to have it because that is a movie I go back to again and again.
There are two I like by him that aren't talked about a lot. The one with the Chevy Chase one, Deal of the Century, which is as close as you can come to a black comedy at that time. It did not work in theaters, and it doesn't work. I won't lie to you. I like it, but it doesn't work 100%. That's about arms dealers. It's with mm-hmm. Chevy Chase and Gregory Hines and Sigourney Weaver. And I thought that was very funny at times. And another one I like was when he did in 2000, Rules of Engagement.
Mm-hmm.
With Tommy
mm-hmm.
Lee Jones and Samuel Jackson, I thought was very good. I like that one a lot, too.
Yeah.
I like his – I'm really appreciative of his – I think it's a 96 remake of 12 Angry Men with Jack Lemmon and James Gandolfini, mm-hmm. Tony Danza. Hume Cronin, Ossie Davis. It's really a great reimagining of that story that, you know, everybody knows. I think he also did that remake of Inherit the Wind too, which was also
no. I don't think he did.
Do that. Okay. But that thing that he did for TV, he's done a lot of TV work.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also,
years.
I mean, 12 Angry Men is 12 Angry Men is in his wheelhouse as well, because you think claustrophobic, you think all those characters in a confined space in some pressure cooker situation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's right up his alley.
Mm-hmm.
True. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah, great work with actors. To Live and Die in L.A.
I love that film.
One of the defining movies of the 80s,
mm-hmm.
would you say?
I would agree with that.
I would agree with that.
Huh? Yeah, for sure. It just has that. It just has, you know, it's funny, you know, did that movie in, what was that, 85?
85 or 86, 85 or 86, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there was just, well, I tell you, I'm still shocked by certain things in that movie, you know. I don't want to give anything away for the people who haven't seen it, but there are some shocking things that happen in that film that no other film dares to do. You know, of course, justifiably, it's famous for its car chase. But I think it's even better. Just that whole sense of excess. You know, there's a sense of 80s excess in it. You know,
mm-hmm.
and plus visually, you know, that sort of the palette that he uses in that movie. He and his cinematographer and the music too. I mean,
yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. what could be more 80s than Wang Chung?
True.
There.
True.
Well,
you know,
I mean, an inside view on the life of a money launderer,
mm-hmm.
you know, a counterfeiter,
yeah.
and the process. I mean, there's that whole great sequence where we still see Willem Dafoe and the process of
that's a great sequence. That's
money.
A great, great, great sequence. You know, the other movie. There's only one movie I've seen by him that I'm not crazy about, and that's Jade.
Right.
I would say that's probably his most reviled movie. Probably. I've never seen it. So is it really bad?
It's not really. I think it wants to capitalize on Linda Fiorentino. It has the unfortunate distinction of also coming out the week after Showgirls, another Esterhazy scripted movie. So it always has that distinction. But it has like the, you know, it tried to capitalize on a lot of things. It was one of those other movies that wanted to make David Caruso a movie star.
Yeah.
It wanted to make Linda Fiorentino a movie star after The Last Seduction. And, you know, it's like all these big things that should be working in his favor. And it just doesn't really, I never felt it worked at all.
And I'd be interested in going back to it because
I go back to it.
I've read in an interview that that's the one movie that he really likes that didn't catch on.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
But there's something about filmmakers where it's, you know, even Coppola is like this. He's made two of the great films. I mean, I think he's made several of the great films of all time. But the ones that are generally referred to as our American classics, the two Godfather films, and he always says, "Well, the one I feel most passionate about, the conversation and one from the heart."
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's usually the one that people don't fully embrace.
Right.
That the filmmaker feels is the kind of the forgotten baby.
The sort of redheaded stepchild.
Right.
Yeah, that they want to be especially nurturing of. And that's
mm-hmm.
that's an understandable position to be in.
Yeah,
we have a caller. I'm going to accept the caller. This person's been on the line for a while. I don't know if they want to speak. But Tennessee, it's a 423 area code. 423 area code, you're on the air. Okay. Maybe they don't want to talk.
Okay.
Anyway. So do you think, in terms of The Exorcist, do you think that a movie still has the power to scandalize like The Exorcist did?
Oh, God.
Yeah, I think, not in that same way. But yeah, I do think that still exists. There's still some buttons out there that haven't been pushed, although it seems kind of ludicrous to say. I mean, after, you know, people like Michael Haneke and so forth. But just look at Michael Haneke. I mean, you know, with Funny Games, but particularly with Funny Games. I mean, that movie totally scandalized me, and that wasn't so long ago, you know, that when that movie was made.
Right.
I mean, it's difficult for me to actually say exactly, describe my feelings after watching that movie. I guess it was primarily a feeling of anger that I had been
hungry. I think that's a general consensus with that, yeah.
Yeah, that I had been hoodwinked, and I went and took the movie back and just said, oh, I can't believe you made me watch this movie because it was recommended to me. But then later on, I began to respect it, and that's even more shocking that I've gone back to it and actually do consider it one of my favorites now.
But The Exorcist is, I mean, certainly it scandalized people. People were passing out in the aisles, and it was almost an entity unto itself. I mean, people were frightened of it, just the mere mention of it. Like, a lot of people thought that's an evil thing.
Right.
But it was a phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So I that's basically what I'm asking. Can we ever see a film that exists like that that becomes a cultural phenomenon?
Yes.
And
scandalizes people
at the same time.
The last real one that was Blair Witch Project, and I feel that falls in that same sort of territory. But it's not going to happen every day, for sure.
No, it's going to happen every couple of years, maybe once a decade or something, maybe. But
yeah. Once a decade.
It also that brings up a very good point, though. That was when you had film was more of a communal experience, though. Even with Blair Witch Project, it was still a communal experience. People went to the theater. Unfortunately, we have, and even though I know Paul Schrader embraces this, or feels he has to embrace it, we now live in a time where I can watch something in the theater, but someone could equally be watching it, downloaded illegally at home, or watched it on their, you know, whatever. I don't know. That's the problem. We're watching it in so many different ways that I don't know if it has the, in that sense, that I think it really, in the sense of The Exorcist, and even in like with the Blair Witch part, you have the communal experience. I don't know if you do have that. Obviously, I mean, I could say that with the Avengers or with Magic Mike. Magic Mike is another communal experience that what was the box office numbers this weekend? I have no idea what was number one.
Ted was one and Magic Mike was two.
Wow, Ted was one.
But,
okay.
But you're right, because even you know, Blair Witch being 99,
mm-hmm.
So looking out 13 years from then.
13 years, wow.
I mean, I can see that movie's release pattern being, you know, VOD and select theaters at the same time.
You're absolutely right, Jamie. I mean, it would be VOD. A lot of things would be VOD. Not that there's anything wrong with that. That's great for the independent filmmaker, because they actually more people will get to see it that way.
But I actually think it would be a lot less of a phenomenon if it had been rolled out like that.
Yeah, no, it would have been a phenomenon. I think you're absolutely right. So I don't know. I think you can have it, here's the thing. Outside of the blockbuster, that's what I don't know. I don't, outside of something like The Avengers or obviously The Dark Knight or Spider-Man, you know, the comic book movies that William Friedkin was talking about, I don't know if you can have it on the independent, on an unknown director.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I don't know if you can ever have that again. And it's certainly not a thing about quality either. It's just a thing about distribution, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing about Exorcist, too, I think, you know, The Exorcist blew people away not only because of its visceral, you know, qualities, you know, of the horror qualities in it, but I think that movie really affected people on a subliminal level, probably, and it's telling of a story of faith, really, and,
right.
And I think it really forced people. One of the things that made people uncomfortable about that movie and made it such a phenomenon, I think, was that element,
mm-hmm.
you know, that twin element of, yes, it is at first glance a horror movie, but at second glance, it is a movie about this priest that's struggling. I consider the priest in the movie to be the main character of the movie, even though it's a supporting role.
Right, but you're right.
It's really a movie about him, you know. So that's the kind of trick that movie plays. But I don't think there are many filmmakers out there. I kind of agree with Friedkin that would take a story like that and actually underline that particular aspect of it, that sort of humanistic aspect.
I mean, we've seen it in all the knockoffs since.
Yeah, I mean, it's something like The Devil Inside or The Right, the one with Anthony Hopkins. I've never even seen these, thankfully. I'm glad I haven't seen these because I don't have much time left, I guess. But I don't want to waste. No, but he's absolutely right there when he says it could not be made today the way he made it. It couldn't.
Right.
It doesn't. If what I always say. If you went into a studio and you said, "Oh, I'm going to make Lawrence of Arabia," they'd look at you like you're nuts. They would look at you. You know, Lawrence of Arabia today would, if you're lucky, would play at the art house theater near you. If you were lucky, I'm saying. And the sad thing is, it would probably be VOD and that's a sad state of affairs. But if William Friedkin went in with The Exorcist today, as is, as he made it, it'd be like, well, you know, where's all the gore? Where's all the, you know, what the hell's going on here? Where are the tits? Where's all this? You know, and we want Piranha 3 Double D or something. I mean, that's a sad thing, but, you know, I'm being facetious, but there's a lot of truth in that, unfortunately, too.
Well, and his point was, you see it in the other Exorcist films. I mean, they just up the quotient in all the wrong areas. They're not an exploration of anything. They're just wall to wall titillation and you know,
He's speaking about the John Borman one too.
I'm sure he is.
My God, the greatest special effect in that is look how many lines are on Richard Burton's face, and no makeup artist had to do that.
I remember Pauline Kael's positive review of Exorcist 2.
I knew you were going to bring that up.
Get out! It was a positive review?
And
I knew you were going to bring that up, Jamie.
She had a negative review of The Exorcist, but it was kind of a positive review of Exorcist 2. She said it had some sort of lunacy that was very attractive, that it was kind of a balls-to-the-wall lunatic vision, and it felt kind of lyrical and loony, and I haven't seen that in so many years.
Oh, God,
but
I haven't seen that. What an act
to follow. I mean, you just can't. I mean, that's a phenomenon that you can't capitalize on. It's just such an accomplishment in and of itself. And I'm talking about the original Exorcist. I'm not talking about Exorcist 2.
No, I understand that. I understand. Although people like the third one, though. People did like the third Exorcist when it came out, though. That did get a kind of positive feedback.
Right.
Nothing short of just like being allowed to breathe compared to the second one is a good reaction.
All right. So we will be back. Hey, what are you doing on the 4th?
I don't know. I mean, we're just gonna have, you know, the regular traditional 4th of July barbecue, but it's so weird. It's in the middle of the week. It's always a weird thing when it's like falls like this.
Well,
I'll probably go to the movies.
Okay, I'm trying to determine when to do our Savages show, since Wednesday's a holiday.
We should honestly do it on. Can we do it next Sunday when maybe we've all seen it? Maybe, I mean. And talk about the movie, because, I mean, I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait to see it.
Well, what I might do it as just a standalone show. I might edit it together as a standalone show.
Okay.
And air it during the week once it's done. And then Sunday we'll be back with Martin Donovan, the actor.
Oh, okay, cool. Can I ask you a question? And if you can't answer it, that's all right. Could you talk about anything else with Don Winslow besides Savages or just about Savages?
Haven't talked to him yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he had to cancel on Saturday, and we're getting back together tomorrow sometime.
Okay. All right. Now,
you have a particular question?
Could you ask him, in all seriousness, could you ask him this question? I can't believe we're going to – I do have a question.
Let's settle this all on the air.
All right. If you don't mind, I mean, ask him if there are any plans to make his novel, The Dawn Patrol, into a movie.
The
Dawn Patrol. It's not like it's about surfers, and one of the surfers, Boone Daniels, is a private investigator. It's a great book, so I love it. I mean, I've read a lot of stuff by him. And the other question, if I can ask you, I can't believe I'm doing this on the air, but the only way I can talk to him is because I have no internet.
Okay. It's a little peek behind the scenes for the listeners.
Yeah, I know. My other question, though, is do I have the copy of the book? No, I don't. But The Life and Death of Bobby Z. Mm-hmm. What did he think of the movie adaptation of it?
Oh, he doesn't like it, but I will ask him.
Would you ask him that and tell him if he would allow me to remake it? Because it's one of my I love that book. I would basically option that, and I'd option the Dawn Patrol right now and go and make them.
Okay.
I love his writing. I really do. And
well, Kings of Cool is a great book. I mean, it kind of expands the story of mm-hmm. savages.
Well, I read a review in the New York Times today, just a short, like they had that short in their crime section, and they had a short snippet, but it explains like how the three main characters, because it talks about their parents, essentially.
Yeah, yeah,
and
multi-generation.
How they ended up like they were, and it was just like, oh, dear.
Yeah. He's a very, very musical writing style.
He does. But you can tell that I think The Life and Death of Bobby Z is one of my favorite books of the 90s. It made a huge impression on me. You can tell him that. I really enjoyed
okay.
that book.
Like, okay.
Balls to the wall, awesome book.
Okay, so I have one thing to say before you go, and since we're talking about things in the future or whatever, I have another idea for a show that I think we should do sometime in July.
Okay.
And, you know, in August comes the Academy's announcement of who's going to win the special Oscars and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
Sometime in mid-August. And I think we should do a show that's devoted to who do we think deserves a special Oscar.
One of their Lifetime Achievement Oscars. Well, we need
yeah.
to find, I'll pull together a website that lists all of the recipients.
Yeah, that would help.
Far.
So I don't
yeah.
make a
yeah.
jackass out of myself. That would
I'm pretty sure Oprah won't be on any of our lists, but, you know.
yeah. So,
you never know.
I think, you know, that's something that I like to do on Filmicability every year is make my suggestions. And I still have a backlog of suggestions of you know, who I think should be pointed to.
All right, no, that's a good idea. That's an awesome idea. That's a really good
yeah.
idea.
Yeah, I'd be very interested to see what you guys have to offer.
Yeah, me too, because I have no idea. But it sounds like a good idea.
It does. It is a good idea. It's a fun. It could be a lot of fun. That would be definitely
yeah.
a lot of fun.
By the way, after our sequel show, that article got out about Big Lebowski 2, that fake article
mm-hmm.
that was circulated to actual legitimate news outlets with a whole log line about what the film was about. And it was a prank. It was a fake mm. article.
Yeah.
But yeah, interesting.
That's
how bad people want that.
Shows, though. That might have been one of our best non-interview related shows, I think, that sequel show.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Although I think you just might have, I don't know how you're going to top tonight's show, Jamie. That was just fascinating. That was a really awesome interview. That
yeah,
was,
it was
utterly engrossing. I did not know, I would say 95% of that, I had no idea.
And I have
to
say, I love
terrific.
William Friedkin's voice. His
mm-hmm.
like the actual quality of his voice.
I could have sworn
yeah.
Adam Wong before. I've heard that voice before.
He's so distinctive, you know. I recognize that voice from
mm-hmm.
just commentaries and so forth. And it felt like kind of speaking to an old friend, kind of in a way.
Very polite and very forthcoming. I mean.
Right.
The interview, because I felt like we were running out of time, my questions kind of got choppier at the end. But for the most part, I mean, it was just a conversation, and he was wonderful with that. There was no set questions. There was just one topic led to another, and it was just a very invigorating talking to him. So I appreciate his time. All right, guys.
All right, awesome. Awesome show tonight.
We'll definitely be back together Sunday night, and then we'll
mm-hmm.
have another show during the week. And actually, I have an hour-long conversation, another one, with our good friend, film critic Tony Macklin.
Oh, cool.
The current state of film criticism, and we'll be covering
that. Well,
that'd
be an awesome show. I can't wait to hear that.
Yeah, that's a fun discussion.
No, I really look forward to that one, definitely.
All right, so close off tonight's show with Tangerine Dream's score to Sorcerer, one of the greats, actually.
Perfect.
I love this.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.
See you later.